Modern Casserole is a podcast of three hungry women. We met working at a food magazine, and each week we talk about food, culture, what we cooked, and what we ate in San Diego and beyond. I'm Olivia, and this is Modern Casserole. Well, hi, ladies. It's so great to hear from you guys. It's actually Thursday, so I'm already thinking about the weekend.
I don't know. What's the weekend these days?
Right. It all kind of blurs together.
It does. But I guess, yeah, I look forward to the weekends and taking the downtime. And I've been really unplugging on the weekends. Have you guys been doing that? I don't know. Something about this experience has helped me compartmentalize my life so much more.
Absolutely. Yeah. I like to think about what I'm going to be eating. That's kind of my like release. What about you, Felicia? Do you have any like big food plans this weekend?
One thing I especially during this time working from home, I like to differentiate between my weekdays and weekends. So one of the ways I do that is with food. And the weekends are a time when we actually can like have the time to make breakfast. And so I've started really looking forward to that. And we have this just array of breakfast dishes that we kind of rotate through. Most of them have kind of a Persian inflection as of methi. So my favorite is something called date eggs. And it is like the ultimate sweet and savory breakfast dish. You saute some eggs in butter, kind of scramble them up, add a little bit of like cream cheese, or I use puck cheese, and then you chop up really nice tender medjool dates and throw them in towards the end. And it's really wonderful. I like to eat that.
Do you have to soak the dates to get them kind of like rehydrated, or just find really good juicy ones that are already like that? Yeah.
If you get good dates, you don't need to rehydrate them. They're so juicy. You can pull them apart with your fingers.
Oh, wow.
Don't get like the little shriveled, sad packaged dates that are in a lot of stores. They usually go to, well, you know, I mean, the weekly plug for Balboa International Market. But we actually have some really phenomenal dates that are grown right here in California. The key is to get those medjool dates, and I think even Trader Joe's carries them a lot of times.
Yeah, they do. The issue I have with the Trader Joe's ones, which we do pick up because they're just convenient, they put them in the refrigerator section, which I think speeds up their drying process, like the drying out process. And I do find if I leave them on the counter, they're more like that, you know, kind of caramelly, like ooey gooey date.
Definitely.
So the room temperature thing, I think, is a big help. And I know at like the international markets, I find that they do store them typically at room temperature. And I think that also helps.
Well, lately they've been sticking them in a cooler, and I don't know why, but the good news is, yeah, if you store them on the counter, they regain that juiciness. Yeah.
I will say though, as far as where they're stored, I have had issues where if I do leave them out too long, you know, they will attract like a bug or something and get ruined, but it's a really rare thing. And also we eat them fast enough that they're not sitting on the counter that long.
So. Same. And literally, dates were preserved for long, you know, desert treks. So they are designed to last forever at room temperature or even in the heat. But you're exactly right. The only issue is infestation. So
yeah,
you always got to break them open and kind of check them.
Yeah. So I know I kind of derailed your description of this amazing dish with the eggs and the dates. And I've actually seen a friend from my time in Israel actually started making that dish. And I didn't realize it was probably based on what you're describing here. And I was always really intrigued with the combination. It wasn't surprising because she was really into the sweet and savory, and I love that combination too. But I just was kind of curious a little bit more about like what, you know, what do you serve it with, or like does it balance with anything else on the plate?
Well, methi loves to have it with either barberry or sangak, which are two Persian flatbreads. They have sesame seeds and nigella seeds on top, and that's really nice. I'll eat it that way, or sometimes just by itself. And it's one of those like home style Persian dishes that you wouldn't find in a restaurant. And actually, methi had forgotten about it. It was my friend Faraday who was, when she came and was visiting from New York, she made it for us. And he was like, yeah, we have this at home all the time.
Oh.
I was like, why have you never given this to me? You know, sweet and savory are my favorite. So yeah, I absolutely love it. And, I mean, going on and on about sweet and savory breakfast dishes, the only thing it reminds me of in that combination is an Emirati dish called balalit. And that's where you take vermicelli noodles. Vermicelli or vermicelli?
Vermicelli.
I always say vermicelli, but I don't know.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah, I think so.
So you fry those noodles in like a simple syrup. So they're soft and extremely sweet. And you toss it with extremely salty eggs. And that's breakfast. Sounds weird. So delicious.
Wow.
So I don't know. I also like just straight up savory breakfast, but it's not something I indulge in during the week. So on the weekends, I always kind of look forward to deciding, you know, what breakfast to do. So.
Wow. I love dates. I love that. I'm definitely going to be trying this out. It actually reminds me, like, one of my go-to snacks, if I have it in the house, is a date with a little bit of cream cheese smushed on it. I know. I'm so glad you guys think that's good, because I gave one to Shai, who's Israeli, and so I thought that wouldn't be too weird of a combination for him, but he was like, what in the world is this? And it's just it was something we had as a kid growing up. My dad is obsessed with dates. It's literally like something, like, I when I think of dates, I think of my dad. Like, it's so strange. And he's always been a surfer dude, and so like that was one of his go-to power snacks, was actually keeping dates, you know, like in his bag, or like have dates with like peanut butter, you know, for some protein on there. But I just always like associated this like really cool, like dad food, ironically. And then of course I went to the Middle East and it was like, I saw dates completely differently, which is really fascinating. But I know Felicia, we've talked about that little power snack combo with like using tahini, with the dates, and doing like a little sprinkle of what we've done. We've done like cacao nibs. Yeah. We've done like sesame seed.
I've been doing sea salt lately.
Ooh,
And it's good.
Yeah. I love dates with like a good, like a manchego, just slices of manchego and bites.
Yes, that's that sweet halloumi. And salty.
Ooh. Yes.
Oh, yeah. Remember those skewers?
Oh, we did that together. That's right. You ladies remember that.
Yeah. The three of us feasted on that. That was amazing.
I got obsessed. I ate it every night after that for like a month. Matthew was like, you need to chill.
We'll definitely put a link to that recipe in our show notes for sure, because I know that's a good reminder. I also became obsessed. And that, the grilled halloumi thing, I fell in love with the cafe I worked in Israel. We had we just called it a halloumi wrap. And it was basically like whatever salad you could fit into this wrap with grilled triangles of halloumi. And it was, and what the key was that we actually put like fresh fruit in with it as well. So again, here's that sweet and savory combination. So if it was strawberry season, there were like slices of fresh strawberry, nectarines, peaches, whatever. And just, oh my gosh. And then it was like cold and hot, sweet, savory, chewy, crispy. I mean, it was everything. So
what more do you want?
Now you have me thinking about like the berry and feta salads that.
Yes.
Stop
it. I know. I'm so glad we all love that sweet and salty combination, because not everybody does. And some people might be listening and be like, nope, not for me. But I just think good, because more for me. So I will eat your portion. but something off of or veering away from the sweet and savory, I also really love just savory breakfast. So my go-to for that is something called sabich. And I'm not choking, but that's literally the pronunciation. It's with a at the end, so apologies. But sabich is a Israeli-Iraqi pita sandwich that started there in about like the 1960s by someone named Sibich, which actually was his first name, Zvi Halabi. And he was from Iraq, from Baghdad specifically. And he brought the tradition of this dish with him from Iraq, from the Jewish community, where you were preparing foods the night before the Sabbath, before Shabbat. So, you know, Friday afternoon, there was a lot of cooking going on, a lot of preparation for the weekend because you weren't supposed to be cooking during the weekend. So, you know, there's a lot of work. So you want to make your life very simple and relaxing over the weekend. So you would have, you know, little bits and things that you would like kind of combine the next morning for an easy breakfast with, you know, with bread or with pita or some sort of flatbread. And so the combination that makes this dish so specific is fried eggplant, hard-boiled egg, boiled, or I guess you could do roasted potatoes, but it's typically boiled potatoes, a chopped salad, like an Arabic or sometimes Israeli salad, you know, that classic combination of tomato, cucumber, you know, it could have some onion in there, you know, lots of lemon, lots of salt. It's just really bright and fresh. And then you also have something called schug. Another not mistake, that's the word. And or you could call it harif, which also, they mean the same thing. It means like a spicy sauce. And then there's something called amba, which is like a fermented mango chutney. Savory, not a like a sweet mango chutney, but a savory one. And tahini or tahina. And that combination inside a pita, or actually I sometimes do it as a salad. Like I just make a ton of that chopped salad and then have all those bits and pieces with it on the side. And it is so good. It's one of those things where like the sum is greater than its parts type of thing. Like each individual, you're like, oh, boiled potato, like whatever. Ugh, hard-boiled egg, that's great. But like, what's the big deal? But like the combination, especially with that eggplant, it like does something really magical to it. It's like it brings in the fat, it brings in the like salt, then you've got like the heat from the harif or the zrug, and oh my gosh, it's
that
so addicting.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah, and it's great. Man.
That's one thing I love about Israeli food. It kind of reminds me of a lot of the American food stories, that it's a country of immigrants. There are people from all over.
Yes, and yes.
So you can actually trace the history of some of these dishes. They're not, you know, ancient dishes lost to time. Like, no, you know the mm-hmm. name of the guy who mm-hmm. made the sandwich. The zug, mm-hmm. which I'm saying wrong.
No, that's pretty darn good. It's pretty good, man. It took me a long time. I lived there for 6 years. It took me almost as long to learn that word. So
if I'm not mistaken, that is a Yemeni condiment.
Yes, it is.
Man, I just read an amazing book, a memoir by a Yemeni Israeli woman called The Art of Leaving. Actually, I just sent it to you.
Yes, I'm so excited to read that one. Yes.
I hadn't really known the history of that particular people group in Israel, and it's an amazing book for that, many other reasons, and their food descriptions always make me so hungry because like... they were the ones to introduce kind of the spiciness to Israeli cuisine,
yes.
whereas the Ashkenazis brought more subtle flavors from Europe. So
yeah, a lot of the pickled things, you know, as we know, from like German influence and things like that. Yeah, no, it's I just recently realized that the Sabich was the name, and what was interesting about this this man who passed away in 2012, but he was making Sabich, you know, since the 60s, and his whole family carries that on. And the neighborhood that he had this stand in, Ramat Gan, which is just like a little suburb of Tel Aviv, I actually lived in. And so I was always kind of like this kind of fun thing thinking about, like, oh my gosh, like this is where Sabich was made. And I didn't know it was a person. And it's incredible because this name, I guess it's from the Arab community. This, and he was from the Arab world, from Iraq. When he came to Israel, you know, he was asked to, you know, a lot of people were asked to change their name. Kind of like when you came, like you're saying, like in America, it's a melting pot. People came here and kind of almost Americanized their name because they were trying to create like a new, you know, like a assimilated or connected culture. So it was like, let's all kind of have something similar together. But
they also forced people to change their name.
Yes.
Like they changed my great-grandfather's name without his permission.
Yeah.
And they're like, you're Runko? You're going to be Runk.
Yeah.
Like, oh, okay.
So. Yes, exactly. I think we probably all could share a story about our names changing
about
over the years.
Forced assimilation.
Absolutely. Yes. So it was kind of, you know, something like that going on there. But he was really proud of his heritage and being an Arab Jew, and you know, really wanted to own that. And he had a Hebrew name as well as Ezra, but he, I think that's where the Zvi maybe comes in there. But in any case, like I said, I didn't realize it was a name, and I just love the thought of like a food named after a person. But almost thinking now when you hear that name that you think somebody's named after the food, you know, so but like,
right,
it's, you know, which one came first? So I just really love the dish. It's actually one of the things that made me fall in love with my husband and his family was spending the weekend with them, because this is my husband's family is Iraqi, and this is what they had in the home. And his father's spicy sauce, this sauce called harif, which is the like Hebrew, or actually I think that might be an Arabic word too. Do you know, Felicia, do you recognize harif
as an Arab word? Yes, but it means monsoon.
I'd have to double check on that, but in my understanding in Hebrew specifically, it means like spicy or like hot. So, or specifically spicy. So in any case, his dad has a homemade recipe that he makes, and I sometimes will make it myself, but I was the first in their family to like pile that on to my sabich combination. And Shai had never done that. Like literally in all of his like 28 years that he had been eating this food, he had never done that combination. And I sit there, this American, like just like doing whatever I want, you know, but like just joy, happiness, and I talk about it. I'm always asking his dad for more tips on making this sauce. So for me, it's so it's different than the schug, which we can talk about too, but the harif that his father makes has tomato, bell peppers, what we would call like a jalapeno, but there it's like more like an Anaheim chili, kind of different shape chili. And then like cayenne pepper, salt and pepper, things like that. But like the key is like you basically like blanch the tomatoes and score them so you can take off the skin and kind of mush everything down, and you cook it with the peppers, and just let it kind of like stew on the stove for a while.
It's cooked. It's not a raw sauce.
It is cooked. Exactly. Which is why it's very different than the schug, which is like a fresh herby, spicy condiment.
Cilantro based, right?
Lots of cilantro, a bit of parsley, and that one also has like different kind of floral spices, like a bit of cardamom, a bit of cumin, things like that. And I've been actually making that at home a lot and serving it with the sabich, just because it's a little easier since it's a raw condiment. But I love both, and I would say, you know, at like sabich stands all across Israel, there's different, you know, everybody's got their take on it. And I just wanted, before we move on to some other notes, I just wanted to say, like, I have this very strong memory of going to a place in Ramat Gan, and I don't think it was the original stand, but it's another one that's been, you know, very well known there. I think it's called Oved's Sabich in Ramat Gan. And this guy, he doesn't take your order to, like, what you want specifically. It's like he asks in riddles. Things about how to make your pita. So Shai I was just asking Shai earlier about it, just to, you know, jog my memory. He was saying that, like, you know, if you want, like, you know, the different condiments on it, like the amba or the harif, you know, he won't ask you, like, if you want it spicy or if you want it, you know, anything on there. He'll be like, you know, if there's a soccer game going on and there's a yellow team and a red team, you know, what would the score be? And you're just like, I don't know, like it's a tie, like 2-2 or like 3-2. He'll use that to say, okay, now I'll give you 3 parts amba and 2 parts harif. Like,
I love it.
It's incredible. And he's yelling, and it's like there's always these really small stands, and it's really this animated like production. And again, they're just like everything's just getting jammed in this pita, and it's great. I just love that. That's something I definitely miss about my time in Israel, and it, just the life and the animation when it comes to
the characters,
the character. Yes. It's amazing. It's amazing. But the eggplant, like I said, is another big contentious thing when it comes to sabich. And I know Maria, you love to cook with eggplant. So I'm kind of curious if you've got any go-to eggplant recipes.
I mean, we probably do like the most American bastardized thing to it, which is to batter it with like the panko crumbs and fry it. I love eggplant parmigiana. My son loves it. So it's on the regular rotation for us. But this most recent eggplant parm that we made, or I should say, I got this massive eggplant at Trader Joe's, and I was thinking of you, Olivia, when I was selecting it, because I remember you gave me this awesome little tutorial once when we were at a farmer's market together on what to look for in an eggplant. But, you know, I didn't want to, like, handle all the eggplants, so we're going for size at Trader Joe's, right? Because all the eggplants are the same price.
Don't leave us hanging. What were the tips for picking an eggplant?
Yeah, I'm curious what you remember from my tutorial, and then we can dive into that, because I'm just kind of curious if I even did a good job explaining it.
You know, probably what I remember is far too general, but basically you want to look for an eggplant that's big, right, but it's light in weight, because you don't want it to be full of seeds. And so, you know, in good faith and not wanting to touch all the eggplants because we've got COVID-19 and stuff, I just went for the biggest one.
Yeah.
And of course I picked it up and it was heavy and I was like, oh, this is going to have a lot of seeds in it.
I love that.
It did.
This is great. And Maria, I think I was thinking about this recently too. So I think it's incredible that we're like on this eggplant wavelength. Mm-hmm. The recent edition of Bon Appetit had a whole grilling section and they focused a bit on eggplant. And I was like, oh, great. I mean, more people should love eggplant. Like, it's something that I had to kind of grow to love over the years. And it took practice, and specifically, again, living in the Middle East where eggplant is like a king, you know, just the way that like cauliflower became like a big thing. I felt like in the Middle East, that's like, you know, it just was always that way. But with eggplant, what I find, like I said, you want one that's, you know, it doesn't have to be large. What you're looking for is the ratio of size to weight. So if you pick up an eggplant that's large and it feels large, that's going to have a lot of seeds. If you pick up one that's large and it feels light for its weight, for its look, you know, like it looks big, but it feels light. That's how you know there's not going to be a lot of seeds. And
what is the downside to the seeds? Let's talk about that a little bit.
That's a great point. So even before that, I want to say that in Bon Appetit, actually their recommendation was to look for an eggplant that's heavy, that feels heavy. So I was like, that's exactly the opposite of the way that I talk about eggplant. So I thought that was really interesting. And I realized maybe they don't mind the seeds, you know, maybe that's what they're thinking about. Maybe they're just looking at like the density of the eggplant. But for me, I personally just don't like the texture of seeds. I know people, again, from my time in Israel that like I have a friend that basically said he went to a restaurant and he got into a big fight with the cook because the eggplant that they served him had all these seeds. And he just was like, how could a respectful restaurant, you know, like serve this to me? This is unacceptable. You know, and I was just like, well, only in Israel did this happen, that people are sending back seedy eggplant. But yeah, it was fascinating. So yeah, for me, I personally don't like it. I also find that type with extra seeds, I get that itchy mouth feeling. Does anybody else get that reaction to eggplant? I get that like kind of itchy mouth. But I find again that I'm able to avoid that reaction with specific qualities of eggplants. And it could also be a varietal thing, but I find more often than not that that's what helps me.
You have a way to tell which one is female versus male, and what's
that
all about?
Yeah, so that's another aspect. So going even beyond just the weight and the size of the eggplant, you want to look for, so, you know, sometimes you'll have kind of like a flat bottom eggplant, and those often will have almost like, sometimes referred to as like the belly button, because it's not on the stem side, it's on the opposite side of the eggplant. And it will have like a flatter bottom, and like the spot at the bottom won't be round like a belly button. It'll be almost kind of like a longer like line shape. Mm-hmm. Those are actually the female eggplant. And then the male, you'll find, has sometimes maybe a little bit pointier of a bottom to it. And it has like just like a circular belly button dot at the bottom. So it's kind of funny. I mean, it's just, you know, I guess it's, you know, an interesting way to think about plants. I mean, there are male and female plants.
Well, which is better for cooking and which is better for raw?
Oh, great. Thank you. I know. I get really distracted by my... But the better one is the male. And ironically, it's because they have fewer seeds. I don't know, anatomically, you'd think it'd be the opposite. But in any case... that's the way it is. So, again, and this could be just a preference thing. For somebody that doesn't mind the seeds, go for it. I don't think there's any harm, but
I feel like the ones with seeds have a higher water content. And so you end up losing a lot of the volume when you cook it.
Do you ladies salt your eggplant before you cook with it? Yeah, me too.
I do personally. I don't. Yeah, I do. I can't. I have a hard time using it without doing that method. I've done it, but I think there's something ritualistic for me as well. But I have a whole method. You know, I do, especially for the sabich, the way that I like to do it is I cut it into kind of like a half moon shape, and they're about a quarter inch thick. So I like it a little bit thinner, and I lay them out on like a baking sheet. On a layer of paper towel, or you could use a kitchen towel, and generously salt it really good on one side, let it sit, and even as it's sitting there, you'll see the water beat up, you know, the salt is melting, and then it's drawing out the water, and there's thoughts that this also helps with bitterness. I
agree.
I think mentally I agree. I don't know if, you know, scientifically it's true or not.
I feel like the bitterness comes from the skin.
You do?
I haven't
experienced that. So because I leave the skin on. I will say I do leave the skin on for this
preparation.
I guess
it depends on what you're doing with it. Since you guys are frying it, it would be really important to get that moisture out. I usually grill it until the skin kind of chars off. So obviously for that I don't.
It's a fascinating preparation because I know I have a friend, she's Persian, and when she prepares eggplant, she actually even washes the salt off, which is interesting. I don't wash the salt off. I just pat it really good with with the kitchen towel. I kind of like press it because that also helps release more of the moisture, and it pulls it out into the cloth there. And I find that it pulls off most of the salt with it. So I don't do the washing method because I'm always worried about it like absorbing the water back in. But I mean, that's how she does it. And she does, I love her eggplant dishes. So, I mean, obviously there's not just one way to do it, but.
Well, do you guys bake or fry your eggplant when you're doing them for sabich or parmesan?
For the sabich, it's fried typically. I have done some baked versions or even grilled when I just don't want to introduce all that extra oil. But I find that if you fry eggplant properly, it doesn't come out too oily, and it's only improved with a little oil is the way I always think of
eggplant. Well, what's the trick? Because I know a lot of times it absorbs so much oil.
Yes. The trick is hot oil. Yeah, making sure it's hot. When you put it in there, you want it really to be bubbling away. You don't want like an explosion. I know we've talked about that before. But definitely you want that fast bubble because the faster they fry, the less time they're in that oil. I also find that sometimes when it looks like it's absorbed a lot of oil, if you let it keep going till it gets nice and golden brown on that side, it actually releases the oil again, which is fascinating because I've put in a bunch of eggplant in a single layer fry pan, and almost all the oil has disappeared, and I'm like looking at it like, oh my God, I'm going to have to toss it. But I literally just like have to like, you know, hold my breath. I just, you know, let it keep going. I check underneath, you know, to see, you know, how it's browning. And as it's browning, it actually ends up releasing the oil back and then everything's good. So it's one of those things where like, panic could take over, but it's experience, you know, over time you start to learn the nuances, I guess, of cooking with eggplant. Do you find the same, Maria?
Yeah, and I mean, I do a shallow fry, so they're not like submerged in oil.
Same.
I use olive oil, so I don't mind it if it gets kind of greasy because I love olive oil. But it does release it, and then, you know, after you fry it, after I fry them, I drain them for a little bit. And they always turn out great. And with this one that we had, it was massive. The seeds actually, I used to think that I didn't like the seeds, but, you know, this time I was really mindful of it for whatever reason, and they did bother me. They were really hard and unpleasant and bitter. But I ended up slicing up this eggplant, and it was so massive. I ate like five times off of it, a bunch of eggplant parmigiana. We also like to slice it up and turn it into quesadillas for lunch. And I love this sabich idea because I feel like, you know, It's just a good way to use up fried eggplant.
Yeah.
And then
I'll definitely put the recipe in the show notes so we can all try that. Like I said, because it's really a combination of things. So it's not even like cooking one big dish, which is, you know, really kind of fun. And I always kind of riff on it. Sometimes I've used sweet potato instead of, you know, white potato or something like that. It's really endless. So What else besides the quesadillas did you get up to with the eggplant?
We just a lot of eggplant parmigiana, various versions of eggplant parmigiana. Oh, so gotcha. Whenever we make it the first night, we just do it with stacks where I stack the layers of the fried eggplant with sauce and the cheese. We like ricotta and mozzarella. And then with the second time we make it is more of a batch because I take whatever is left over and then do the casserole style and we bake it to reheat it. Yesterday, I finally finished the second batch that we had made for lunch, but it's better twice baked because when I baked the casserole off, I baked it for like 45 minutes at 425 and it, you know, gets all good. And the second bake though just really brought everything fully together.
I always find food the next day, like I like leftovers. I know some people aren't big on them. I like them because all the flavors have usually married. My mom growing up, she'd be like, it's going to be better tomorrow, kids. Like, and it was always very great often. The first night, but then she was right. Always the next night, you know, something which you mean like a chicken cacciatore or something. It's like everything gets together.
But I think that's the key though, Maria. Like it's that reheating it properly.
Yes.
Like in like rebaking it instead of like nuking it in the microwave or like we make, like we freeze, we batch cook Persian stews and put them in our freezer and they're so much better than like the second or third or whatever time we're heating them up because we cook them rather than, again, microwaving them. We put them on the stove with some water and just let it reheat and reduce. So it intensifies the flavor too. So I think maybe all food could be better if we just don't microwave it.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I hate when I have to microwave something.
I went like 5 years without using a microwave because I got scared of it. I think it's more about microwaving stuff in plastic, right? Mm-hmm. But, you know, I use it every once in a while for convenience. But because of that experience, I realized, you know, the food is just better if you reheat it in the oven.
Yeah.
That is a great tip. Well,
I can't wait.
Sounds like if we all try making ceviche this weekend, we will have all kinds of leftovers. But we won't even have to reheat it.
Nope.
It in there.
I know that I was gonna say that's actually the whole beauty of that dish is that it was made for not even needing reheating because you can't actually heat things on Shabbat.
I mean, one last question on this sandwich because I'm now obsessed. So the frying of the eggplant seems like the biggest effort in it, and I would imagine they'd get kind of soggy the next day. How do you keep them crispy?
So it's interesting. I just asked Shai about this the other day because I'm obsessed with his mother's version and I'm always, you know, aspiring to reach that level. And I was asking him a little bit more like some of her techniques. And he was saying that, you know, she actually salts them and has them in a colander overnight. So even though I'm doing it like literally on a paper towel for, I do maybe 15 minutes on each side, you know, as I'm chopping and doing all my other stuff. But she does it actually overnight. I think she starts it like Thursday night so that she can fry them Friday morning. So that's one thing. She gets a lot of moisture out. And also she stores it room temperature on paper towel, you know, in between
once
different layers.
Once they're fried.
Exactly. And, you know, they don't stay crispy, I would say, in this method, but they stay delicious. They stay great. But I have, you know, at like a sebich stand where they're doing it fresh, I've been to ones where they shave really, really like paper thin slices, like of the whole length of the eggplant. And then they're deep frying it that way. And then you get it, you know, pretty fresh right then. You do get a bit of that crispiness with it. But I would say, honestly, what's interesting about this sandwich is that there isn't a lot of texture coming from anything else besides like the chopped salad, as far as anything kind of crunchy. Everything else is kind of like soft and unctuous and just delicious. And it's more of that combination of flavors. But like the texture that I like with it is like that chopped salad that kind of, that brings the brightness and brings that little bit of crunch. But everything else just kind of melts together and becomes just one amazing flavor.
That's what I love about eggplant. It gets like, it kind of gets creamy.
Silky.
Silky. Yes. There you go. And it just like goes through everything else. It's so good.
I hope that we've made people like crave eggplant because I'm like
coming
really...
into season soon.
Well, yes. And a starter eggplant. For people who are intimidated, the Japanese eggplant, I feel like, is so much more accessible. You don't have to worry about the seeds, the skin. I find tastier.
It's thinner, smaller, I think, even.
It's thinner. I don't know.
They're almost
sweeter. I am a big fan.
sweeter, yeah. you said? Yeah.
I think so. I'm not a fan of the Thai eggplant too much, just because I've had so many renditions that were not properly prepared. We had an amazing Thai eggplant together, Olivia, with at Kettner Exchange. That was extraordinary.
I'm so excited for the weekend now, because I think, like I said, I love the sabich. I just made it for the first time in a long time last weekend, and now I'm pretty sure it's on the menu this weekend again.
Awesome. Well, I can't wait to hear about your different versions, and
I can't wait to get your recipe.
Yes. Yeah. It'll be in the show notes, so look out for that, and I love to hear your takes on it as well, and we can practice saying sabich.
That's right. Between now and next week, I'll practice making it and saying it.
But you know what? It doesn't matter how you say it, as long as you eat it and you love it. So that's all that matters. So
yeah.
Thank you for listening to Modern Casserole. You can find our show notes at moderncasserole.com with links, photos, and recipes from this week's episode. Subscribe today on our website and everywhere podcasts are available.